We had the new Putin's visit to China. Before Putin going to China, there was new tariff on Chinese from 25% to 100%. Biden increased the tariffs. And Xi embracing Putin the same, the first time we've seen something like this. I have never seen in my life such a thing that Xi doing these things. And Putin is not the hugging guy. He's not, no, none of them is. But we saw something different. We haven't
I
seen
think
this
it
before.
was, I think this was indeed a transformational moment. The relationship between China and Russia has been a very complicated one. It began in the 1640s when Cossacks arrived in Siberia, and the newly established Qing or Manchu dynasty in Beijing, encountered them. It was an unfortunate meeting in that the Cossacks apparently ate some of the Chinese. They were cannibals because they were starving. And people went back to Beijing and reported there are cannibals to our north. This was not a good start for the relationship. It was solemnized in a treaty between the Russian Orthodox Church and the Chinese imperial government. And this is under this agreement, 16 hectares in Beijing were allocated to the Russian Orthodox Church. Those 16 hectares are today the embassy of the Russian Federation in Beijing. So there's continuity. Russia participated, along with other Western countries, Western from the point of view of the Chinese, in taking vast parts of Chinese land and also dividing China into spheres of influence. And in 1902, when the Boxer Rebellion occurred, the Russians contributed forces to the Eight Nation Army that slaughtered tens of thousands of Chinese in and around Beijing to put down the rebellion. Obviously, the history later was one in which the Chinese Communist Party alternately embraced and divorced the Soviet Communist Party. And in fact, in the 1950s, China leaned to one side, as it said, in the Cold War. For 10 years, it was a close ally of Moscow. But around 1960, that relationship fell apart. And for another quarter century, 25 years, China and Russia were enemies. And they even fought battles on their border. And this led to the opening with the United States, which sought to recruit China to help contain Soviet Union. When the Soviet Union expired and the Russian Federation reemerged from it, the Chinese were very clear-minded and took the long view. I remember discussing this with them at the time. In the early mid-1990s, they said, Russia is collapsing. It's on the way down. But in about 10 years, meaning early in the 21st century, it will bounce back and it will begin to recover and it will resurge. And when it does, we are determined that it will be our friend, not our enemy. And they've kept their eyes on this objective and they achieved it. But what they achieved until recently was entente, that is, a limited partnership for limited purposes. And this entente came into being in common opposition to hostility from the United States. But the nature of the hostility and the strategic pressure on each country, Russia and China, was different. In the case of Russia, Russia withdrew from its sphere of influence in Europe, did not attempt to reestablish itself on the understanding, on the basis of assurances from the United States that we would not try to fill that vacuum with our own forces. We broke that commitment and we pushed steadily toward the Russian border with Ukraine, the last prize. So in the case of Russia, Russia was acting defensively against a perceived mounting threat and the establishment of a hostile presence on its borders. The situation in China is quite different, because after World War II, when the United States defeated Imperial Japan in the Pacific, we filled that vacuum. And for 70 years, the United States was the unchallenged hegemon, if you will, the great presence that we enjoyed strategic primacy throughout the Pacific Asia. And now the Chinese are back again, as they were historically. They are now the center of their own region. We have responded to this by increasing our force presence and the level of hostility to China. So in the case of China, it's a case of the Chinese pushing against a former American sphere of influence and are defending it. These are very different situations, to be sure. But what they amount to is enmity by the United States toward both Beijing and Moscow. And it is hardly surprising that when you try dual containment, as we have done, you push the two parties you are trying to contain together. And we have now succeeded in doing that, because the limited partnership that had been forged between Xi Jinping and Mr. Putin has now become a very broad and deep entente. It is not an alliance. There is no formal commitment, as far as I am aware, no uncontingent, open-ended commitment by either side to the other. But the number of subjects on which they now agree in opposition to the United States is very broad and deep. And that is a change. This relationship is almost an alliance now. The United States does not seem to know how to deal with this. We are continuing on the course of pushing Beijing and Moscow together. All of this is happening while the situation in Ukraine turns very much against the West, the United States and NATO, in favor of Russia. And while a new administration in Taipei seems to be doing things that risk restarting the Chinese civil war on a military basis rather than simply a political basis. So China has been divided. Taiwan, Mr. Lai, who was elected president in Taiwan, gave an inaugural speech in which he basically adopted the language of one China, one Taiwan, or an independent Taiwan. This has been noticed in Beijing. It's a provocation. And the administration, meanwhile, the U.S. administration, as you indicated, continues to pile on the tariffs and sanctions and other hostile gestures toward Beijing. And this increases the likelihood both of war over Taiwan and of Russian participation in whatever happens. So this is a very important visit, this last one. And I think you're correct to note that the embrace, the hug, if you will, in Zhongnanhai, the leadership inhabited part of the Forbidden City in Beijing, is symbolic of a change in the relationship.
Yeah. We know that Putin, just in his new administration, he's replacing the head of the Ministry of Defense with an economist. Shoigu is gone. He was promoted. It seems that the new head of Ministry of Defense in Russia is an economist. I talked with a Russian expert. He said that one of the reasons for this decision was the expenses on the part of the Ministry of Defense has passed 6%, and they want to bring it down again. And the other experts believe that Putin is preparing for a bigger war. This war, they are considering, if NATO comes in, if NATO tries to attack them, they want to be well prepared to any sort of attack, any sort of escalation in Ukraine. What's your understanding? What's your take on this new administration of Putin?
Well, I think there are two basic motives for putting an economist, apparently a very honest economist, not a corrupt man, in charge of the defense ministry. One is that the role of the defense ministry in the Russian economy is now very much larger than it was before this war began. The defense budget has doubled. Military production has increased manyfold, and not just doubled. And the military sector of the economy is once again driving a lot of innovation and absorbing a lot of investment. And the belief is that a lot of money has been wasted and that this sector of the economy has to become more efficient. And this is something the new defense minister is apparently qualified to help happen. Second reason is that, as is normal in any war, there has been a lot of corruption associated with the defense sector, and the new defense minister is meant to clean that up. Now, the question of whether trying to make the defense sector more efficient, or perhaps even larger than it is preparation for peace or for war, is an open question. I think it is an effort to cover both possibilities. You cannot rule out a wider war with NATO, and therefore Russia must be prepared. But you can also hope that there will be a negotiated peace in Ukraine, with Ukraine, and some understanding with the United States and NATO about different security arrangements in Europe that reduce the danger of war and provide a sense of security both to Europeans and to Russians. So I think that Mr. Putin is trying to cover both possibilities, and that's probably wise. You can't tell what's going to happen. So I would say I don't have any idea, and I doubt that any expert on Russia, which I am not, has any idea exactly what Mr. Putin expects. I think we can tell what he fears, which is a wider war, and he's getting ready for that. What he hopes for is a peace, and he's getting ready for that.
Yeah. We know that Zelensky's term has finished. He's continuing under the martial law in Ukraine. Do you see any sign of change in the mind of the Biden administration that they go after some changes in Ukraine and maybe find a political settlement?
That's a very complicated question. I really don't know the answer. It's very clear that many more people in the United States are now aware that Ukraine is not a democracy. It does not have functioning opposition parties. Its media are a state monopoly, and freedom of speech is limited. Information is very carefully shaped for political effect. So this is a state which relies on a lot of techniques that the famous Russian Prime Minister Potemkin would have understood. The ideological basis for support for Ukraine is eroding in the West. I would say also that what is likely to happen is going to be determined by Ukrainians, not by people outside Ukraine. And there are many pressures on Ukraine. There is the pressure of Russian advances in the Northeast, Kharkiv region, for example. There is the pressure of Russian advances also in the South. What is happening on the battlefield is not encouraging from the Ukrainian point of view. Also, Ukraine has been encouraged by the British and some Americans to fire missiles deep into Russia and to attack targets deep inside Russia. This is irrelevant to what happens on the ground in Ukraine. It does nothing to stop the Russian advances, but it does encourage the Russians to fire back. And in fact, that is happening, and more Ukrainian infrastructure is being destroyed. So we're in a war of attrition, in which, and in that, in every war of attrition, the larger, more populous, richer country has the advantage. And in this case, that is Russia. So there's a lot of pressure on Ukraine. Do people in Ukraine, now that they do not have a constitutionally legitimate president in Mr. Zelensky, will they take action to change their government? I don't know. But I think the pressure on them to do that is mounting. And we hear that the former chief of staff of the Ukrainian Armed Forces, General Zaluzhny, is prepared to offer himself as a leader of Ukraine. And presumably there are others similarly ambitious to try to do something to save their homeland. What is clear is that time, at the moment at least, is very much not on Ukraine's or Mr. Zelensky's side. So I don't know what will happen, but I can see many reasons to suspect that Mr. Zelensky, one way or another, cannot last forever as the chief of government in Ukraine.
There is a summit in Switzerland, and Lula from Brazil and the head of South Africa, they were invited, but they said they don't go there. They're not going to be there in Switzerland. Lula said he's not going to be there, the head of South Africa as well. And we still don't know what if Chinese would send a representative to this summit. But how?
I think we can be fairly confident that the Chinese will not attend, for the simple reason that this is not a peace conference. This is a conference to rally support for Ukraine against Russia. In that regard, it resembles the conference in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, some time ago, where the Russians also were not represented. You cannot make peace or even talk seriously about peace if you do not invite the enemy to the conference, and Russia is not invited. So to go to that conference would be to take the side of the United States and Ukraine against Russia. I suppose Lula doesn't want to do that, and I suppose Cyril Ramaphosa doesn't want to do it either, and I'm pretty sure Xi Jinping will not do it either.
The other thing that I think in the mainstream media, they're not talking about what's going on in Georgia, and it's so important, it's so crucial, it's so fragile, the situation right now in Georgia. And we've seen that there is a new law passed by the parliament on foreign agents and then vetoed by the president of Georgia. And we've seen the foreign ministers of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia protesting on the streets in Georgia against this law, against what's going on. In your opinion, is that normal to see foreign ministers of another countries protesting something internal, something, a discussion that is going on in Georgia?
No, it is not normal. It's not in accord with international law and practice. There is an irony here in that the Foreign Agents Registration Act, which was passed in the United States and has been used politically against various countries that the United States considers unfriendly, but which has exempted others. For example, Israel does not register, despite the fact that it has the most powerful lobby and has been the most active intervener in American politics of any country. This law set the precedent for another 60 such laws internationally. Georgia is simply the latest to do this. And when you see foreign envoys and prominent foreign politicians marching in the streets of Tbilisi in support of vetoing this law, and you are actually seeing that the law is being validated, because it demonstrates the reality of foreign interference. You know, in an ideal world, nobody would have to register and everybody would be free to make their point. But that is not the world we live in. And if you try to make a point in the United States on behalf of, let's say, China, or let's say North Vietnam, I mean, North Korea, you'll probably go to prison very quickly. So if you try to make a point in Georgia that is against Russia, why should you be exempt from similar treatment? So I think this is part of a symptom of the general breakdown of international law and due process and the rule of law generally. And, you know, in that regard, I'm seeing a very sad convergence between political systems. Used to be the rule of law is very simple. It is the rules are made by a consensus of the society. They are published and they are adjudicated by an independent judiciary. That is the rule of law. There is something called rule by law, in which a dictator makes the rules, changes them at will, sometimes doesn't publish the rules, keeps them, their rules, keep them secret, and looks not to conduct a judicial process, but to punish his enemies and reward his friends. And that is an alternative system. It's not uncommon in the world, unfortunately. And we're seeing more and more of it, and less of the rule of law, more of the rule by law. And in this connection, finally, what the United States advocates, the so-called rules-based order, is very clearly rule by law, not rule of law. It is contrary to international law. And we're seeing a breakdown of international order over this issue. And what is happening in Georgia now is merely part of that, not unique.
What's going on in Georgia, in your opinion, is the kind of movement to distract Russia from what's going on in Ukraine, or it's something serious that that may bring Russia and the United States in Georgia to have another fight?
I don't think the United States and Russia will become directly involved in the fight over Georgia. I think Georgians are very badly divided in their views. And I'm sure eventually Georgia may very well get into the European Union, if the European Union survives, which is not certain. Differences among members of the European Union are getting greater rather than lessening. Georgia will never be in NATO. Georgia will not again be part of a Russian-controlled domain, as it was in the Soviet Union. Therefore, I don't think the stakes are quite as high as they are in Ukraine. Of course, we all remember that Saakashvili, the former head of the Georgian government, was emboldened by the invitation to join NATO and launched a war against two rebel areas in Georgia, South Ossetia and Abkhazia. And that war, he lost. And those relatively small countries are now independent, recognized only by Russia and Russia's friends. We're seeing wars at the periphery in Ukraine, and we did see it in Georgia But I think in Georgia, it's over. It's not going to be repeated. And we don't know how the Ukraine war is going to end, except we can be pretty sure it will end unfavorably for Kyiv.
In your opinion, Russia will take Odessa and Nikolaev. Is it going to end up a landlock?
I don't know. I mean, a great deal depends on what Kyiv decides to do. If Kyiv continues to attack targets in Russia and therefore make the case that its alignment with the West is unacceptable as a threat to Russia, then I don't know what the Russians will do. If Kyiv decides to make peace, I think Russia will compromise, but not if Ukraine refuses to compromise. Why should Russia when the war is going in its direction? By the way, I think from a military point of view, and you should ask one of your military guests about this, taking Odessa is not easy. Crossing the Dnieper River is not easy. And you have, basically, in order to take Odessa, you have to do that. You can't, I mean, it's been what? Almost 80 years since a major amphibious operation was mounted and succeeded. We haven't seen that since World War II. It's very difficult. It's particularly difficult if Ukraine continues to sink Russian ships in the Black Sea, which it's doing. You know, from the point of view of Ukrainian defense, that makes sense. It doesn't help Ukraine defend its territory, but it does reduce the threat to Odessa or places like that.
Just to wrap up this session, I want to talk about Xi's visit to Europe. He went to France, Serbia, and Hungary. We've seen that his main visits were to Serbia and Hungary. He didn't achieve anything in France. But how did you find this trip of Xi? What he's looking for in Europe, in your opinion? What he's looking for in the eastern part of Europe? These are two countries who are friendly with Russia.
Well, I wouldn't agree that he didn't accomplish anything in France. France has always aspired to lead Europe in strategic autonomy rather than subservience to the United States. And this visit served Macron's purpose, his purpose, and Xi's purpose in terms of keeping that idea alive. It didn't achieve it, but it underscored the importance of independent decisions on the part of the great countries of Europe, of which France is a major one. In Hungary, there was an explosion of agreements on cooperation. And Hungary is, of course, not just part of NATO, but a European Union member. And therefore, these agreements, commercial agreements, investment agreements, and put China into the European Union common market and enabled it to compete. Very good for Hungary, probably not so good for some of China's competitors in Europe. Serbia is a special case because, of course, Serbia has always been very close to Russia. Serbia is the remnant of the former Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia was very close to China. Many Serbs have studied in China and speak Chinese, just as Albanians do, from the time of Enver Hoxha in Albania. And so Serbia is a country that has a friendly relationship with China. And of course, it was the site of the American bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. And therefore, going to Belgrade and celebrating or remembering that moment was important to Mr. Xi Jinping for nationalist reasons. So I think this was a trip that made sense. It kept alive the idea of European autonomy. It established a bridgehead for Chinese industry in the European Union, and it reaffirmed a close relationship with Serbia, which is an important European country, even if it is not in the EU or NATO.
Do you see any of these European countries, Eastern, especially Eastern part of Europe, joining BRICS, in your opinion?
I haven't really considered that question. My guess is that any relationship between BRICS and Europe is going to have to be worked out with the EU rather than on a country by country basis. After all, the BRICS began essentially as an international protest movement against American primacy. It has become something more than that, but how much more, we don't know. But it is a multilateral organization. It has, as I've explained elsewhere, but I think not on your show, I don't like the word multipolar, because as an engineer, you will understand that a pole is a line, the end of a line between two points. But the world is far more complicated than a bilateral arrangement between two points. And so I preferred the word node, I guess, nudo in Spanish, I don't know, Portuguese. And this is a point of convergence where vectors can begin, connections of various dimensions and intensity can occur, and it takes place in a network. And the network is the nature of the world we're now seeing emerge. It is not divided like the Cold War between two poles, and it will not be divided between another two poles, Beijing and Washington, the so-called G2. This will not happen. And the BRICS is an effort to establish a network. How much will be done within that network remains to be worked out. And it's natural within a network where you have many nodes, thinking, for example, of Brazil as a node connected in many ways to many countries, some circuits that are very heavy and much trafficked, and some that are very light and don't have much content to them. It's very easy to see how a country like Brazil would find this arrangement very, very useful. Why? Because it is an obvious alternative to subordination to the United States, to China, to Russia, to India, to whoever. It allows Brazil to maintain its autonomy and to pick and choose what it does internationally. So I preferred the word multinodal to multipolar, but perhaps that's just a peculiarity on my part. Yeah.